Hello, Gallatin Valley. You're listening to KGVM Bozeman on FM 95.9. This is Dr. Nurse Nancy welcoming you to Body Politic, a program about how our ability to control what we do with our bodies and what happens to our bodies shapes our life experiences. Our topic today is sex doors. In the first half hour of this show, we are joined by Dr. Lynn Camella, Professor of Gender and Sexuality Studies at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Dr. Camella is co-editor of the book New Views on Pornography and author of the book Vibrator Nation. Later in the show, we'll visit Erotique, Bozeman's own downtown sex shop. But we'll start by talking about how, back in the 1970s, feminist stores began to change the role that some sex shops play in our communities. Dr. Camella, could you please start by talking about how sex shops used to be run and regarded, and how and why the women's liberation movement began to change that?
Sure. First, thanks for having me on your show. I'm really happy to be here and talk about, you know, this history of kind of feminist sex toy stores and the legacy that they have kind of had in changing the commercial landscape of sex toy stores. I think for your listeners, in order to really set the stage for the role that feminism and feminist sex shops have played on the industry, we really need to kind of take a time machine back to the early 1970s, because so much was going on in terms of women embracing feminism and through feminism rethinking so many things that many, many women had just simply taken for granted in their lives. And one of the things that women began to talk about and engage with and think about was the role of sexuality in their lives. And there was so much going on at that time in terms of women writing about and talking about the politics of female masturbation and the politics of female orgasms. They were talking about kind of the importance of women getting to know their bodies and embracing their sexualities. And one thing that was a topic of conversation among some women was the importance of women kind of embracing tools of liberation. And for many women, that included the vibrator, which took on a new kind of symbolic meaning in the early 1970s as a tool of liberation and a way that could help women get to know their bodies and even have orgasms. And that was really key for women who were having trouble doing so or who weren't doing so at all. So that leads us to the sex shop, because women were hearing all of these wonderful things about reclaiming their sexuality and the kind of advantage of, you know, purchasing and owning vibrators. And they were literally looking at each other and saying, that sounds great. I'm down with that. Groovy, even. Where do I get those? You know, where's a place where I can walk in and feel comfortable enough, where I'm not going to be harassed, where I'm not going to have to experience objectification or sexism by virtue of wanting more out of my sex life? And that's where the early feminist pioneers enter the story. So in 1974, in New York City, a woman by the name of Del Williams started Eve's Garden, which started initially as a mail order operation and then became a brick and mortar store. And a couple years later, a woman by the name of Joni Blank founded Good Vibrations in San Francisco. And in each of those cases, it was a case in the early 1970s of these women looking around and seeing a need. And there was a need that they thought they could fill just by creating alternative spaces where women could feel more comfortable as sexual beings and, you know, kind of looking for and purchasing things that could enhance their sex lives. And these stores were tiny. And they were started by women who didn't consider themselves business women. They considered themselves, you know, women's liberationists or sex educators. But they saw a need in the marketplace. And they, you know, kind of really in very do-it-yourself kind of ways, set about to fulfill that need by creating these stores. And what we've seen in the decades since is that what started as these teeny tiny little stores that a lot of people kind of, you know, raised their eyebrows about, or, you know, around, they just weren't sure if, you know, what were feminists doing selling vibrators? That didn't sound like feminism to them. So there's a lot of skepticism initially, but what we see today is that those pioneers really did start a kind of feminist sex toy retailing movement that, you know, in the decades since has really blossomed into something quite significant culturally.
So I really want to tell you my Eve's Garden story, the store started by Del Williams, which was the first store geared toward women and their pleasure and sexual health. I have to say, the very first sex toy store I ever walked into was actually here in Bozeman. I think it was 1981, and it was Erotique, or Ms. Kitty's, which has become Erotique, and we're going to be later today, we'll be interviewing people there. But that was kind of, I was cheating, because it was actually an assignment for a women's studies class I was taking. So I was supposed to go look and write a paper on, like, did I think this was good for women? So, you know, it didn't really take much courage. I had the out of, oh, it's not for me, I'm writing a paper on this. Uh-huh. But then I went to graduate school, and some of my classmates gave me a $50 gift certificate to Eve's Garden. And I thought, what? This is crazy. I was afraid to go there. But one day, my girlfriend and I, we had just moved into a new apartment. We painted it, and the paint fumes were so strong that I just had to get out. So I stuck the gift certificate in my purse, and I went to Eve's Garden. And I was so scared. But I walk in, and was across the street from Carnegie Hall. It was on the 13th floor of this beautiful office building, very elegant. And I walk in, and there's this tiny, old to me, I was 27, she was in her 60s, tiny old lady eating an egg salad sandwich behind the counter. And I thought, this isn't so scary. And she said, oh, you have a $50 gift certificate. You should buy the magic wand. It's the best vibrator. And I lied through my teeth and said, I already had one, which was so not true. And I ended up buying like $50 worth of books on what the doctors say about women's orgasms. But I was looking for work. And Del asked me, she was looking for help. So I gave her my phone number and my address. Turns out I had memorized my phone number incorrectly. About 3 days later, I got a letter in the mail saying, I think you would make a lovely addition to the Eve's Garden staff. Please call me. So I did. And she said, you know what? Tomorrow is Monday. We're closed on Monday. I'm not going to be there, but I'm going to leave the key with the dentist next door. And I'd like you to come in and spend 8 hours becoming familiar with the merchandise. And the next thing I knew, I was like getting paid to be all by myself, which was good because I would have been afraid in front of other people to learn about all this stuff. And I ended up staying at Eve's Garden for 2 years. I became vice president. I carried the Eve's Garden card in my wallet very proudly for decades until someone stole my wallet. But it was such a great, great experience for me. But so that was in the late 80s. I'd like to go back a little to even before then. Let's talk about, like, this was a time when the women's health movement was encouraging self-examination. Mm-hmm. People were using mirrors and flashlights to look at their vulvas for the first time, et cetera. Partly because of the need to learn about our bodies for abortion, but also for pleasure. Can you talk more about Betty Dodson and her masturbation workshops?
Sure, I can. First, let me say, I love your Eve's Garden story. I just want to acknowledge that. And what's so really wonderful about that story is that it really mirrors so many stories I heard during the course of conducting my research for Vibrator Nation, from women of all ages who encountered these businesses at different points in their lives. But it's a really great story, and it's really exceptional that you had that experience with such a historically important business. So that is, I love that story. But Betty Dodson, is really an important figure in this history, because she was, for a time being, one of the only brave feminist souls who was kind of talking publicly and writing about masturbation and the female orgasm in the early 1970s. So, I write about Betty Dodson extensively in one of the early chapters in my book, because she, very courageously, spoke at a female sexuality conference that happened in the early 1970s in New York City. And she actually kind of came out on stage and came out about her vibrator use and said that she was probably going steady with her vibrator. And at that same conference, she held a workshop on female masturbation, trying to demystify it for women, because we have to remember this was not a kind of, topic of conversation that many women were used to. And so Betty really was like an ambassador to female pleasure. And for her, the gateway to female pleasure was masturbation, because that allowed women to learn about their bodies. And if you didn't know about your bodies, it was hard to communicate to somebody else about what you liked, what you didn't like, what was pleasurable, what might lead to an orgasm. So, she ended up writing a book that she self-published initially called Liberating Masturbation, which just, kind of made its way around, the women's movement. People bought it, ordered it, through mail order catalogs. Del Williams sold it at Eve's Garden. But in addition to that, Betty Dodson started doing what was called body sex workshops, and she held them in her apartment in New York City, and it would be a kind of weekend-long workshop where women would come, small groups of them, 10 to 15. They would all take off their clothes as soon as they entered her apartment. There was wall-to-wall carpeting, and there was macrame on the walls and plants in the corner. She would lead them through breathing exercises. She would, create an environment where they could relax and meditate and get in touch with their bodies. And then she would show them how to masturbate. And Betty was an artist. She was trained as a fine artist. And one of the things that she argued was, it's very difficult to kind of masturbate and figure out what an orgasm is for a lot of women if you've never seen it. There was something powerful to her as a teacher about providing her students with the visuals that they needed so they could then see for themselves that, the female orgasm isn't necessarily all of this, writhing head back ecstasy that we see in the movies. It's like this, or it's like this, or it's like this. And that workshop was really important for a lot of women, including Del Williams, who had taken that workshop and was so inspired afterwards that she marched to Macy's department store in New York to get her first vibrator, only to be embarrassed in the course of shopping in the electronics department. So Betty Dodson really did, the work that she was doing, kind of inspired some of these early entrepreneurs and became a kind of foundation for how they thought about the importance of, female masturbation, women taking control of their orgasms, and again, having the tools that could help women do that. And we have to remember that this was an era where there wasn't a lot of kind of discussion among women about the important role that the clitoris played.
Right. So
they were doing a lot of education about female anatomy, there might be a reason why you're not having an orgasm,
right?
Because, you're not really familiar with how female anatomy works, and in particular, how important the clitoris is to female sexual pleasure. And there's a lot of basic education going on, which dovetails with some of that important feminist health education, right?
Well, so let's talk about the myth of the vaginal orgasm, which was an article that I think was written in 1968 by Anne, I don't know how to pronounce her last name, Cut, C-O-E-D-T, Cut, okay.
Kurt.
In any event, I think it was published in 1970. And I guess it came out of the idea that Freud had said that women who needed clitoral stimulation in order to achieve orgasm were infantile. They weren't fully developed. That a fully developed, mature woman accepting of her place only needed vaginal stimulation.
Right.
So can you talk more about that article and some of the education around all that?
Yeah, again, really, really important foundational article. And there were similar articles, too, that started to circulate around that same time. But you had these feminist writers who were, challenging what they argued were myths around female sexuality, right? That, the mature form of female sexuality was kind of exemplified through penis in vagina, sexual intercourse that would lead to an orgasm. That was what many women kind of, knew of as heterosexual sexuality. And here were women who were not necessarily feeling pleasure or gratification or experiencing orgasm from that type of sexual act. So you had these writers who were really peeling back, the kind of, myths around not just heterosexual sexuality, but heterosexual gender dynamics. And they were saying, that these definitions of sexuality aren't coming from kind of a female point of view. These ways of considering what is normal sexuality are really privileging a male point of view. And we need to kind of challenge these social constructs around pleasure, around heterosexuality. One of the things that some feminist writers started to challenge was, this kind of myth of the female orgasm coming out of, penis and vagina sex, and really saying, we need to center the clitoris as, kind of a really central aspect of female anatomy and female pleasure. We need to challenge these heterosexual gender dynamics that have historically downplayed female pleasure, at the expense of women's sexual fulfillment. And there were a number of articles that, again, were very influential, that were widely read by people like Betty Dodson, by people like Del Williams, by people like Joni Blank. And those helped to form a foundation for how they thought about their businesses and the educational role of these businesses. It wasn't just about selling things for these women. It never was. It was about creating an environment where people, but women in particular, could come and ask questions, get accurate information about sex, about their bodies, and if they wanted, a product that might help them explore both of those things.
My understanding is that prior to the feminist stores that we're talking about, most sex stores were geared toward men, and women's role in them was really as objects of pleasure for men. They were objects, not subjects. And I remember the importance of education at Eve's Garden. I remember I visited Joni Blank's store in San Francisco, which was great. And I remember Joni Blank came to Eve's Garden, and I got to meet her. And I was explaining something, and I said as an aside to Joni, who actually was a sex therapist, something mm-hmm. like, "But I'm not a sex therapist." She was like, "Yes, you really are. You are a sex educator." For listeners who may just be joining us, you're listening to KGVM Bozeman on FM 95.9. This is Body Politic. Our guest today is Dr. Lynn Camilla. Dr. Camilla, let's talk a little bit more about this role of feminist sex stores as a place where people could get information. I remember Dr. Ruth Westheimer used to send people to Eve's Garden all the time. Let's mm-hmm. talk about the educational role a little more.
Yeah, the educational role is really central to the missions of these businesses. And we've talked about, you know, the early kind of feminist sex shops, Eve's Garden and Good Vibrations. And in the decades since, I just want to acknowledge the fact that there's been a real proliferation of businesses that really base their model on Eve's Garden and Good Vibrations. And they can be found in cities such as Minneapolis, Baltimore, Albuquerque, Northampton, Massachusetts. And one of the kind of key components of this business model is sex education. So, Self-Serve in Albuquerque actually calls itself a sexuality resource center.
Okay.
And that's, you know, true across a number of these businesses, even if they're not using that specific language in their advertising and marketing. So the idea is basically that feminist and kind of queer identified or queer feminist and queer run sex shops can double as not just commercial entities, but resource centers for adults, people 18 and older, who have, you know, questions about sexual anatomy, physiology, response, or, you know, just basic information about kind of what sexual products exist in the marketplace. And they take this role really very, very seriously. And I think part of the reason why is because Del Williams and Joni Blank realized early on through their businesses that people were coming in with a lot of really basic questions. There was just a lot of really basic information that people didn't know about their bodies, about sex, about pleasure. And they saw that sometimes all people needed to do was to have a space where they could feel comfortable asking a question and getting accurate information. And then what they considered a personal failing or a problem really wasn't a personal failing or a problem. It was a lack of information. And they saw that just providing people with accurate sexual information or accurate information about their bodies could be transformative. It could boost someone's self-esteem. And if someone's self-esteem was stronger, well, that could trickle out to their relationships. It could trickle out to their work environments. It could just make them feel better overall. So that has become a cornerstone for these businesses. And it's increasingly important because we have to recognize sex education in this country remains abysmal. It is just terrible. And it doesn't just affect middle school kids or high school students, it affects people who grow up into adults. And so what Joni Blank realized, because she was a sex educator and a sex therapist, was there's a general sexual illiteracy in this country. And, you know, adults kind of, you know, suffer from it, not just young people, but adults, and that these kind of more sex positive, educationally forward sex shops who have, you know, really well trained staff, some of whom have graduate degrees, some of whom have backgrounds in sex therapy or in public health, that these are really important resource centers for individuals, and they're important resource centers culturally. You know, the culture is better because these stores exist. Why? Because these stores are doing the work that isn't happening in other segments of society.
Yeah. You mentioned a little bit about the queer movement as an influence then. Could you talk more about that? About that, how, I mean, that was one of the things in the 19th, you know, late 60s, early 70s, through the 70s. The women's movement was going on, sexual liberation, abortion issues, all kinds of stuff. But part of that was mm-hmm. the gay liberation movement.
Yeah, I mean, none of those things can really be separated from the other, right? Like, they were all influencing each other. They were influencing how, you know, activists talked and wrote about ideas about gender, ideas about sexuality, and, you know, also ideas about kind of what was considered quote unquote normal, right? And so, you know, there were dialogues happening across these different activist movements. But one of the things that's really important and deserves to be emphasized is that if we look at the history of feminist sex toy businesses in the United States, a number of these have been founded by women who identify as lesbians or who identify as queer. And you know, that's worth kind of noting, that people who kind of have not always existed, you know, as kind of, you know, have existed more culturally on the margins, really took up these projects as being important, you know, important to women, but also important to queer people, right? That you want to create, you know, these kinds of spaces where through the selling of sex toys, you can actually challenge dominant understandings of gender and sexuality. And they've taken that task very, very seriously. So I think, you know, there's definitely historically been kind of, you know, the gay and lesbian liberation movement in the 1960s that emerged in the, you know, mid to late 1960s really dovetailed with sex positive feminism. And both of those things have kind of propelled each other forward in a variety of ways. But one of the places where you find that intersection is in these stores.
Absolutely. Looking back, I would say I know that Dell Williams did not necessarily identify as straight. Many of us on the staff identified as queer. And on Tuesdays, Renata White, who was a trans woman, would come in and she would be there as a resource for male to female trans people, mm-hmm. especially who were dealing with issues of needing to find products that would help dilate their mm-hmm. their new vaginas. And it was just such a wonderful place. So many different currents, so much positivity and activism and support going on. Dr. Camilla, I really want to thank you for joining us today. You have been listening to Body Politic on KGVM Bozeman. FM 95.9. Stay with us for the second part of our show, where we will be visiting Erotique.